You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Fisher Stevens' latest film, a documentary called Before the Flood, examines how people around the world can work together to prevent the worst-case scenarios of climate change and the consequences of failing to act immediately. It was made in conjunction with Leonardo DiCaprio, who interviews scientists, politicians, activists, and many others on how best to transition our economic and political systems into environmentally friendly institutions. Fisher Stevens is an actor, director, producer, and writer. As an actor, he's known for his portrayal of Chuck Fishman in Early Edition. In 2010, he won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature for his film The Cove and the 2008 Independent Spirit Award for Best Documentary Feature for his film Crazy Love. Before the Flood opens tonight at the Village East and will then air globally in 171 countries and 45 languages on the National Geographic Channel beginning October 30th. I'm very pleased that it has brought Fisher Stevens back to our show. Welcome back.
Gracias. Merci. Thank you.
The film opens with Leonardo DiCaprio describing the painting The Garden of Earthly Delights by Hieronymus Bosch. And that kind of sets the tone for what's to follow.
Yeah. Ironically, that painting, which was just probably a $2 poster of the painting that Leo's father, George DiCaprio, hung over Leo's crib as a young boy, actually had a tremendous influence on Leo. And, of course, his father did as well. But that painting kind of stayed with him, and he learned a lot about that painting as he got older. And we kind of bookend the film with Bosch and the painting, because it is three panels, and it goes from paradise to hell.
And Before the Flood is the
the second panel. Yeah, the second panel is called Humankind Before the Flood. So,
hasn't Leo been a climate activist since the 1990s? You show him interviewing then-President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore on the topic.
Yeah, we do. You know, the movie is really about climate change, but it's also Leo's journey. So you get to learn a little bit about Leo in the film and see that he's been really active in this field for some time. And I think one of the things that drove both of us to do it is that even though Leo's been an activist sort of since 2000, not that much has changed. And we were finally both getting a bit fed up and wanted to make another film.
How did you come to collaborate on it?
We knew each other, you know, as Carrie Fisher has a great line in the celebrity cafeterias, you know, you run into each other at the celebrity cafeterias. And then went on an expedition to the Galapagos Islands with Ted and with Sylvia Earle, the oceanographer. So we went diving and got to be friends. And I ended up making a film about Sylvia Earle called Mission Blue that Leo saw and then called me and asked me to do this film with him.
You include clips of various conservative broadcasters making fun of him for his environmental activism after Ban Ki-moon named him a UN messenger of peace with a special focus on climate change.
Yeah,
they say, well, you know, he's no scientist. But then those same people reject what the scientists say.
Exactly. They say, yeah, we wanted to, you know, also we wanted to make a very entertaining film and make a film where you know Leo isn't taking himself completely seriously, but he is, it's a serious topic, and he gets a lot of slack from particularly Fox News and Breitbart and those.
He gets flack. They don't give him slack.
Yeah, he gets slack. You know, so, yeah, they shoot at him pretty hard. And so we acknowledge that. And they don't believe in climate change. And even though, yeah, like you say, they don't believe Leo, but they don't believe 97 or 98 out of 100 scientists have said climate change is real. It exists. It's just like gravity. So,
did his status as a UN messenger of peace help you get interviews?
Well, it helped us with the movie. Uh-huh. It helped us shape the film. Leo, we had.
Well, not everybody gets an audience with the Pope, for example.
Right. That was the Pope didn't really care that he was a movie actor. The Pope probably didn't know who he was. But then when he was the messenger of peace and then Pope saw all the work Leo was doing, that is what got us the Pope. That is true. It took a long time to get President Obama on board, and we tried very hard to get the Koch brothers to do an interview, David and Charles Koch, who are mentioned quite a bit at one point in the film. They refused to speak to us, and James Inhofe, the senator from Oklahoma, who's the head of the Environmental Committee in the United States Senate, refused to speak to us. But other than that, we had pretty good success getting who we needed.
There have been a number of previous documentaries about climate change, but a few as visually beautiful as yours. Do we need to see those striking images to get a sense of how serious the problem is?
I think so. I think visually, I mean, you need to understand the beauty of the world, and otherwise it's, you know, we could show a lot of doom and gloom. I also, Leo and I wanted to make a film. We wanted to make a cinematic experience. We wanted the audience to feel something. There have been a million movies made on climate change, as you said.
Not that any of them have had the kind of impact you would have liked to have seen.
Right. That's the thing. And we will have to keep making films. I mean, I don't think we're finished, because it's a subject that is so, so important, and people don't want to talk about it. As Leo says in the film, they tune out when you bring it up. So you have to make the film emotional. You have to make the film beautiful. We had incredible music by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross and Gustavo Santaolalla and Mogwai. And, we'll keep making these films until people wake up.
Were you surprised by how little mention was made of it during the three presidential debates?
Not at all, on
the Wednesday debate.
Not at all. And everyone said, can you believe they haven't brought it up? And I was saying, well, they're going to have to bring it up in the third debate. They're going to have to. They didn't. This is the whole problem. Like, how do you make people understand that this is a huge issue? You want to talk about, you know, the ex-president's infidelities? You know, you want to talk about half of the things that were discussed in that debate were rehash of the last debate. Instead of, like, new topics like climate change, which is why we have to make these movies.
Well, do you think that they really would prefer not to talk about it? Part of the decision was obviously Chris Wallace's. He could have brought it up. But I have the feeling that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton would prefer not to have to go into this in any great detail.
Well, certainly
Hillary
Donald
has kind
Trump.
Of come out for fracking, and Donald mm-hmm. Trump, of course, is a total...
Hollow shell of a man.
I wasn't going to say that.
No, you can
but
say that.
But he's a denier. I almost said a Holocaust denier, but he is definitely a climate change denier.
He's a denier of pretty much everything except Donald Trump. But, Hillary, listen, I believe in my heart of hearts that because of Bernie Sanders, actually, Hillary Clinton has moved a bit in terms of understanding this issue, getting to know this issue, and understanding the importance of it. Yes, she's still for pro-fracking, but we can move people. And I'm hoping that she will become even more environmentally friendly than even President Obama, who's, you know, the last few years, he's been a big champion of the environment, which makes it, you know, in the 2012 debate with Romney, climate change never came up. And now look at what Obama's doing. So
my guest is Fisher Stevens, whose latest film is called Before the Flood. And it is opening tonight at the Village East, and then will air globally as part of the National Geographic Channel series on October 30th, all over the world. The first time you were here was as an actor. When did you transition into focusing mostly on making documentary films, although you've made a couple of features as well?
Yeah. My first documentary I got involved in, I was a producer on and raised the money, and the person that actually paid for the movie said, if this is not good, you have to fix it. And I was like, oh, it's going to be great. It's about New York in the 70s when Pele came to play soccer and Giorgio Canali and the forming of this team, the New York Cosmos, and it's Hollywood and New York together because Warner Brothers ran the team. So the movie was delivered to us, and it was awful. And the investor's like, you better fix this, man. And I didn't know what I was doing. But the producer is a producer from London named John Batsek, who had already won the Oscar for One Day in September. And so I'm like, we got to fix this, man. And together we fixed it. I think the movie turned out really well. Miramax bought it. And
so you fell in love with
the form. got to interview people. You know, you tell the story in the editing room and just thought, this is an amazing form. And you get to travel and meet the most interesting people. You know, when you're acting in movies all the time, you're always around actors. And we are wonderful sometimes, but we can be a little self-obsessed. And so it's nice to take the attention off yourself for a while.
Leo interviews Dr. Michael Mann of the University of Pennsylvania in the film, who he's published with some of his colleagues a graph of climate that shows a slow decline in temperatures followed by a steep hockey stick of warming.
Yeah.
And he says since he published it, his life has never been the same again. He's received death threats.
Yeah. There's a guy in the film that you see briefly named Mark Morano, who's basically a talking head on Fox News, a climate denier who's being paid by the oil company lobbies. And Mark Morano has admittedly sent Michael Mann death threats, among other people. And
he still keeps his job?
Who, Mark Morano?
Yeah, I mean, if I sent death threats to anybody, I think WMIC would wisely get rid of me.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
That's the only reason I don't.
That's why you don't, because otherwise you'd have to work at another radio station. So I don't know. That did he keep his job? That is probably his job. So these guys make Michael Mann's life hell, and then they talk to the Congress and the Senate, and they say, look, this guy, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But he is one of the most knowledgeable people on climate scientists on the earth.
I understand the fossil fuel industry's motivation for denial. But do you think they really believe what they're saying?
No, not all of them. No, they've even admitted.
You think James Inhofe really thought that he was making a strong point when he brought that snowball into the Senate?
I think James Inhofe is a rare breed of human being that actually does believe in his heart of hearts that man cannot change the climate, and is, you know, he's an old bitter gentleman who doesn't even really want to look at the facts. And it's sad. He's probably a nice person, but he's a really sad person, and his position unfortunately is very powerful, and he will do everything he can to make sure that climate legislation and all these new standards and restrictions Obama put in about carbon emissions, he's trying to stop them, as is Mitch McConnell, I don't even think he believes in it. He just believes in the mighty dollar and keeping his position as a senator. And
comes from a coal mining state.
He comes from a coal mining state, and he has to answer to his constituencies at the expense of everyone else. And I feel bad for coal miners, believe me. I mean, it's hard on them right now. I mean, the coal industry is fortunately going away, and these people do need work. And I think the one thing Hillary Clinton has proposed is a way to subsidize these coal miners while they're finding new ways to work and find new jobs out of the coal industry. So, but Mitch McConnell is a big problem.
Also, Governor Rick Scott of Florida, who won't allow the words climate change to even be in any Florida documents. What does he say to Philip Levine, the mayor of Miami Beach, who has to deal with sunny day flooding, rising ocean floods that drain and flood the streets?
Well, Rick Scott and Mayor Levine do not have a very good relationship, I would say, because Philip Levine is trying to get some of those funds from the state, and Rick Scott tells him that's not our problem. You know, that's climate change. It doesn't. He's a climate denier, and so it's. I have to say, when we were filming in Miami, and I've been to Miami, but I had no idea about how imminent it is that the water is rising. And when we finished shooting our first day, we were coming back to our hotel, and there was a stench going out of the sewage. And we looked, and because of the water rising underneath, there was sewage just running down the streets of our hotel, where our hotel was. And it's a real problem there. So Philip Levine is in a bad situation, a bad spot. And, you know, hopefully, you know, Rick Scott's not up for re-election, sadly, but Marco Rubio is up for re-election. And Marco Rubio is also a guy, as we show in the film, who denies man-made climate change, denies many other things too. But it's time that these people get out of the Senate. These people get out of politics altogether, or they really learn and understand the facts. So we get frustrated. You know, it's another reason that we made this movie and we wanted it out before the election. So I'm not saying that it's going to have any sway one way or another, but if you see this film and you vote for Marco Rubio and you live in Florida, I'd say you should move.
My guest is Fisher Stevens, the award-winning filmmaker, whose latest is Before the Flood, which opens tonight at the Village East and also will air globally in 171 countries in 45 languages on the National Geographic Channel beginning October 30th. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Fisher Stevens, whose latest film is a documentary called Before the Flood, which opens today at the Village East Cinema and also will air globally in 171 countries in 45 languages on the National Geographic Channel. That must have been a project in itself, translating into all those different languages.
Yeah, I had to do it all myself. It's incredible. I just learned Taiwanese. It's incredible language. That Nat Geo have been an amazing partner. And when Leo and I finished the film, or were almost finished, we knew we had to get it out before the election because we wanted people to know who they're voting for. So at the end of the film, you can actually go to a website that will tell you who these congressmen and senators are. Where do they stand on the environment? And there are many other things you can do, including paying a carbon tax.
And let's talk about that carbon tax for a moment. Everybody seems to agree that that's one of the best approaches, and yet there's so much resistance.
Yeah.
Just because it's a tax?
Tax, yeah. We have this wonderful Republican in the film named Professor Gregory Mankiw at Harvard, who explains that the carbon tax is one of the most important things to do in order to quickly curb climate emissions. And if you pay a carbon tax, then you can cut other taxes. And that's one of the reasons he's in favor of it. And then that money can also go to social programs. So that's important. John Kerry, who's in the film, we screened it last night at the United Nations. And when he was a senator, he had 55 votes in the Senate. He needed 60 and was trying to pass a cap and trade, which was a close thing to a carbon tax. But what we're hoping is that people see the film, they write their congressmen and senators and say, I am for a carbon tax, and they can pay their own voluntary carbon tax, because Leo and I definitely spend a lot of carbon and we felt like we had to offset it. And then we thought, let's have everyone offset it. And you can pay your own tax-deductible carbon tax, which will go to reforesting of rainforest in Indonesia, in the Congo, or in the Amazon, at your choice.
Isn't it just a matter of what you're going to be paying for? If you pay for a carbon tax, you're paying it one way. If you're paying for cleanups in Miami, which will be flooded, worse and worse, islands that are disappearing in the Pacific, as you point out, if you're breathing in air that is destroying your lungs, as the Chinese has motivated the Chinese to now change their policies, it winds up costing money
one way or another.
One way or the other.
Well, why don't you run for Senate, Leonard, in Florida or in one of these states? Yes, that is the whole point, and that is why we're so frustrated. Why don't people get that? But the other thing we do say in the film, and this professor at Harvard brilliantly says it, is that politicians will do what their constituents want.
He says elected leaders are actually elected followers. They follow the polls.
Exactly. But they won't do anything unless we tell them to do it. So it's up to us to tell our politicians we want a carbon tax, to tell our politicians climate change is important, to tell the people who host these debates, ask questions about climate change.
So, doesn't the Pentagon have a keen interest in seeing meaningful action to combat climate change?
Yeah, but, you know, that's the Pentagon. What do they know about climate change? That's what a lot of people in our Congress and Senate think.
They think that if we don't resolve the problem, we're going to be faced with mass migrations and wars, and there already are some wars that can be linked to climate change.
Yeah. Yeah, they think that. And President Obama brings that up in the film. And he's also, you know, off the record was like, yeah, it's pretty shocking to me why we can't get Congress and Senate to listen. People, that is what actually is the most dramatic thing that can happen quickly, is that these mass populations who live near the coast will need to move. And that can cause real distress.
You mentioned earlier that you had to work a little hard to get the president to participate. But hasn't he really come on board fully? He had an event that ended with a showing of the film, and then there was a discussion with you, Leo, climate expert, and the president.
Yeah. I wasn't part of that discussion.
Oh, you weren't?
But Leo, I was, you know, I was there.
You were the cheering section.
I was the cheering section. Yes. Actually, a Christian minister, a very, very Christian woman named Catherine Aho, Dr. Aho, and Leonardo and Obama did a panel on climate change. The president went to South by Southwest, the festival, and spoke at it last year and thought it was a really amazing experience. So he told his staff he wanted a South by South lawn. So it was a day of talks and music on the White House lawn with people, and then they culminated in this climate change discussion, and they set up a giant screen on the White House lawn, and we got to screen the movie with the Washington Monument lit up behind it. It was quite an experience. And the president, you know, he has been a champion. He's made giant marine protected areas. He's curbing carbon emissions in terms of how much is allowed in this country, making the EPA make much tougher standards. He believes in this issue. He's one of the architects of the Paris Climate Accords. Without him, that would have never happened. So he's been a great champion.
No, we have been adjusting. I just came back from California and driving through some areas, you see arrays of solar panels and you see a lot of windmills. But we haven't made the kind of commitment that other countries have. Germany gets, 30% of its electricity from solar panels?
Solar and wind, yep. Germany, and some days in Denmark, it's 100% from wind. Sweden has actually made a vow to go 100% renewable. The good news, Leonard, is that this year was the first year that there was more investment in solar and wind and geothermal than in the fossil fuel industry, in terms of investment. So that's good, and that's partly because of the Paris Climate Accords, because they're getting hip to that. We have to change. But we could do it a lot faster, and you know, we have to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, and we still are subsidizing it, keeping oil at a price so we can all buy it at a cheap price, as opposed to putting money into subsidizing these other alternative forms of clean energy.
A number of politicians, including Barack Obama earlier in his career, now Donald Trump, talk about clean coal. Yeah. Is there such a thing as clean coal?
There's no such thing as clean coal. That's absolute bollocks, as they say in England. There's cleaner coal. There's coal that you can scrub so that less emissions go out, but it's still dirty. It's all dirty. Natural gas is another big problem, right? You know.
Well, we've been told that natural gas is better than petroleum, but how much better is it?
Well, the problem with natural gas is the methane that comes out of the ground. And methane is 20 to 30 times more powerful than CO2. So I don't think people, you know, to be fair, the natural gas industry didn't really know at the beginning, of course. They didn't really know the methane or so. We didn't know, certainly. And now we know. And the other problem with natural gas is when you're fracturing in the gas out of the ground, when you're fracking, a lot of problems can happen, like poisons and toxins get into the water tables, as we've seen in a lot of places. It's really damaging to the earth around it. So natural gas, you know, this is where I think President Obama and I guess, don't see eye to eye right now. But he really thinks it's good as a bridge fuel because we're not relying on foreign oil as much, and it's plentiful, but it's also a huge, huge polluter. It is a fossil fuel. It's bad.
Vegetarians point out that just all of the beef that we eat plays a major role in this because cows provide a lot of methane.
Yeah, cows provide a lot of methane.
We all draw the line somewhere. I'm not giving up my hamburgers.
Maybe you could cut down on them, Leonard. And plus, it's going to be good for you. It's going to be good for you. Yeah, so we basically do prove and show that eating beef or beef certainly as a mainstay of your diet is a bad thing for the environment and probably not so good for your health, though we don't get into it. So the other problem with beef is the amount of land it takes to grow food for cattle. And that is one of the main drivers of deforestation. And the Amazon, in particular in Brazil, has been just destroyed because of beef cattles for cattle and for feed.
But also the Amazon is being destroyed for other reasons, just for farming in general. And you also show Indonesia burning. They're burning one of the great rainforests so that they can farm there?
Yeah, make palm oil.
Oh, palm oil.
Yeah, it's...
Which is in so many products.
Palm oil, I mean, no one's going to go to this movie now because they're going to think it's so depressing. But it isn't. It's uplifting at the end. I promise you, you'll be inspired.
Well, those images of the fires are just gorgeous.
Even if they're destroying
the
world.
Releasing an awful lot of CO2 into the air.
Yes. So what's happening, what people don't know, or you know it if you are a documentary film geek like me, and seen them, there have been movies made about this, but basically the ecosystem in Indonesia has the third largest rainforest. It's gorgeous. There's only 20% of it left. And most of the reason, beside timber, the biggest driver of that is palm oil plantations. So what they do is they destroy the rainforest, they dry it out because it's millions and millions of years of carbon actually that's been sequestered in the ground. They burn it to dry it. That goes into the air. That is just like carbon bombs going off into the air. And then they replant palm trees, which look really, pretty if you have one. But when you have millions of rows of palm trees, that doesn't sequester carbon anymore. And it is all for this crappy thing called palm oil, which is in Doritos, it's in Cheetos, it's in cup of soup, it's in everything that we eat. So we point out that we've got to tell the people that are making this stuff not to use this palm oil that's destroying the rainforests.
But there are palm trees all over Southern California where you live. They're all over.
I live in New York.
Well, Brooklyn. Where Leo lives. All right. in Florida and elsewhere. Can't we get our palm oil from all of those trees that line the streets of Los Angeles?
Yeah, that industry is going to be huge. Let's start that. This is a real problem because we go to this place called the Loser Ecosystem, and it's the only place left on Earth where you have wild orangutan, wild tigers, wild rhinos, and orangutan, rhino, tigers, and elephants all living in this place. And there's only 1% of that ecosystem left, the Loser. 1% of that little place. So it's not
So where
only,
do those animals go?
They're either burned to death alive or they flee. And we shoot at a refugee camp. We film at a orangutan refugee sanctuary and an elephant sanctuary. So there are wonderful people that are taking these animals in.
You include an interview with Sunita Narain of the Center for Science and Environment in Delhi, and she tells Leo that 700 million people in India cook with cow dung. What would happen if they switched to coal?
Well, and then
is cow dung better?
Cow dung you can only cook, right? If they switch to coal, that means they're going to have electricity. That means they're going to have, they're going to have more. Right, these villagers have nothing. They basically the only power they have is cow dung, and to cook on. There's no lights. There's nothing. So she's talking about when it becomes industrialized. When there's when these people like get a house that's wired. When they get a TV, that will all be powered by coal at this point, unless India goes fully renewable, which it's trying to do. So she's pointing out, U.S., you guys caused this problem, so. We're not, you got to help us fix it. because you got us into this mess. You and, you know, your friends over in Western Europe, you guys, but especially you, U.S. She kind of lays into Leo pretty heavily, and me. I was there talking about how we are we're the villains. We did it. And that we need to look at the way that we live our lives, or you got to give us money. Put your money where your mouth is, Leo, she says to him. So, yeah, she's an amazing character, and she's done great work in India, and her NGO is amazing. So that was a great honor to work and meet her.
If America adopted renewable energy and conservation at the scale that's necessary, who would be the winners and who would be the losers of that change?
Well, this is the whole discussion that we had with Secretary Kerry, where really the way this is going to work, Leonard, the only way we're going to get out of this mess is if people see a way to make money, right? If they feel that these giant companies and corporations or these new innovators in Silicon Valley or in New York City or Brooklyn go, I'm going to get rich doing this. And like an Elon Musk, it's good for the world. It's good for the environment. And it will make us stop taking the fossil fuels out of the ground.
Couldn't coal miners be trained to make solar panels?
Absolutely. They should be trained to make solar panels. And you know, by the way, being a coal miner is not a great for your health either. You know, being a solar panel installer, yeah. I think you can live a healthy, long life being a solar panel installer. But still, we need these companies. Total, the French oil company, is now really investing heavily in wind and solar and in geothermal and in all kinds of other alternative clean fuels. So they've taken a big step. We're hoping that these other giants who have all this, all these assets in the ground, because Leonard, remember, there's $20 trillion. Remember, you didn't know this, but there's $20 trillion worth of oil and coal that's already been paid for, or that already is the stockholders are already expecting to be lifted out of the ground. If that comes out of the ground, we're also screwed. We can't sustain it.
The New Yorker just published an article by Elizabeth Colbert called Greenland is Melting. But that's something that you witnessed firsthand.
Yeah, that was that's a really interesting.
What happens if Greenland, the ice on Greenland melts? There's one shocking scene where a scientist shows Leo a pipe or a tube.
It's a tube, yeah.
That had been buried at the bottom of the ice, and now it's all out there. All the ice melted, and it's something like 30 or 40 feet long.
Yeah, that was that really shocked us. I mean, that was, I'd say on our whole filming, that was one of the scariest things that we'd seen. So he buried that hose 5 years ago, and it was only 5 years that all that ice melted. And the entire continent, basically. So you imagine like 30 feet lower in 5 years of ice. So where does that water go? That's the entire lower Greenland. So that water goes into the ocean, and that is what causes sea level rise. And that is what scientists are so afraid of, because they didn't think it was going that fast. And then you have the South Pole, which is also having a similar melt. So you got the two poles, which are the air conditioning of the planet, both shrinking at the same time, and all of that ice has to go somewhere. And where does it go? It goes into the oceans, which makes everything rise.
Leo asks, is it in the film, can we change our course in time? Don't some people believe that we've already passed the tipping point?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean,
is there cause for optimism?
I have optimism, because I wouldn't be spending time making this movie if I didn't feel like, okay, if we stop now, we can do something about it. The scientist, Piers Sellers, at the end of the movie, who's at NASA, which is the most kind of has the best equipment to measure climate change, probably in the world. NASA, you know, respected. We got us to the moon. He has hope, and you learn that he's making it his life mission to tell people that, like, we can turn it around, but we got to do it now. So he's an inspiration to me. And also the fact that wind and solar is becoming so much cheaper, and it's going to be economically more feasible for everyone to start buying electric cars and hybrid cars. All the pricings are going down, so it doesn't have to be just the elite that can afford solar and afford these cars. And that's what it is going to take.
Isn't there a problem with electric cars that they require electricity, which is usually generated through fossil fuels?
Well, you know, you can do the old Tesla power pack now, and you can actually, which is, I think, about, you, for a decent sized home, it's about $7,000. You need two of them. They're $3,500 each, and you can power your home and your car with this power pack, because the storage, it's the most advanced way to store sunlight and to store your solar energy. So no, you don't need coal or natural gas to power your home.
Fisher Stevens' latest film is called Before the Flood. It opens today at the Village East Cinema, and then will be aired globally in 171 countries and 45 languages on the National Geographic Channel beginning October 30th. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Did
for
it feel uncomfortable being in the guest chair? You've already sat in this chair.
I really, really enjoy your chair better. And also, you have a much nicer and more comfortable chair and padding. But yeah, maybe I can interview you someday, Leonard. That would be nice.
We'll see.